At least when people see a human skeleton, they're interested somewhat. When people see a burned up seat, even most archaeologists, they aren't very impressed, and most archaeologists don't pay much attention to them. In fact, most of them get thrown out. That is changing slowly, I'd say, especially over the last 10 years. And I may be wrong about this, but I have a theory that one of the reasons that the study of ancient plant remains has been so slow to catch on in this particular part of the world, Palestine and Jordan, is that people have been overwhelmed with ruins like Petra and Jerash. First, the initial impact of these monumental sites. Secondly, pottery became a very important study because it was so useful for dating the periods of occupations of site and tracing trade routes and so forth. So much attention of the early archaeologists was placed on architecture and pottery that other things were more or less forgotten. It also seems to me that what's happened now is that New World archaeology, North and South America, is starting to influence Old World archaeology to a great extent. And I think that's especially true in the field of paleobotanical studies. There were paleobotanical studies going on a number of years ago, but not very many people. And I'd be interested with Gary and some of the New World archaeologists we have here, people who have a lot of experience in the New World, to get their reaction. But in the New World, you don't have that many sites like Petra, or at least typical American Indian sites. Very often, you have very little remains in terms of architecture, of pottery, and so forth. And so I think the New World archaeologists have had less material to deal with. Therefore, they've gone after all the material they could get, including plants, lithics, and so forth. Okay, we're just catching up with the New World in terms of the analysis that's being done on materials like plant remains. There are a number of things that plant remains can be used for. One of them, of course, is dating. In fact, just as accurate dating as pottery very often, by the use of C14, carbon-14 analysis. And in fact, over the last few decades, that was about the only use that ancient plant remains were put to here. Big disadvantage, of course, with carbon-14 is that when you run the carbon-14 dating process on the plant material, you burn it up, you destroy the evidence in the process. But of course, that didn't bother anybody too much because after all, they're just plants and not that important. Along with the dating, we're beginning to realize now that plants can be very important for determining the exact period of time in which human societies made the transition from bands of hunters and gatherers to settled agriculturalists. You've heard Gary and Scott talk about that transition being made. And you might recall that in Ilse's lecture, when she was talking about animal bones, she was pointing out that certain bones you can look at and tell if they're from a domesticated sheep or a wild sheep, or various kinds of wild animals and domesticated animals. So the morphology, the structure of the bone changes under domestication. The same thing happens with plants. That seems strange to a lot of people when they hear it for the first time. You know, a domesticated plant, obviously you don't have plants. But once human beings start gathering wild plants and planting them, cultivating, harvesting, and replanting, certain changes take place in the plant. And in laboratory analysis, you can tell whether or not this plant was growing wild or whether it is, in fact, domesticated. So if you have a nice stratified site and you find at the very bottom layers a lot of wild plant remains, right about usually in the Neolithic period, you'll find a gradual transition being made, and suddenly you're getting domesticated plants. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the ways in which you can determine the difference between wild and domesticated plants. Once you get into the period of agriculture, basically from the Neolithic period onward, the plants can tell you a lot, certainly about the agricultural system, what crops were being grown, and perhaps there's one term I'll probably be using to emphasize, and that is a cultigen. A cultigen is simply a plant that is cultivated. Sometimes cultivar is another term that's used. Wheat, barley, things, so forth, as opposed to a non-cultigen, one that grows wild. So you can tell what crops were being grown. Very often you can tell whether irrigation was being practiced or not, and other aspects of the agricultural regime. For example, whether crops were being rotated. Also, just like pottery, you can trace the trade routes of pottery. You can very often tell at least something about trade from the ancient plant remains. Since, for example, in the Jordan Valley, certain things like olive is often said not to grow in the Jordan Valley, but in fact it does. But almond requires a cooler temperatures, higher elevation. So if you find almond in a place like Baba Draw, which in fact we do find, you know that they're importing agricultural goods at least from the plateau into the Jordan Valley. Also, diet. Coming to conclusions about the diet, and I should also emphasize, you know, that it's not a static thing. If you dig the plants carefully and stratigraphically, which again very seldom is done, but you can see changes that are taking place in the agricultural system, in the human diet, and so forth. It might seem strange, but you can also deduce at least some things about ancient political, social, and religious institutions from the ancient agricultural system, and we'll also deal with that right at the end of this evening's lecture. Finally, it seems to me that at least for the general public, perhaps the most interesting thing about the study of ancient plant remains is that from it you can tell much more about what life was like for the average person in ancient times than you can very often from other types of cultural remains. We know from big structures perhaps what the royalty lived like, what the politicians were doing, kings, princes, and so forth. But from the actual agricultural system, you get a good idea of what the average peasant was doing and how he or she was spending their day. Terms, I've already used one term, paleoethnobotany. That sounds like a big, complicated term, but it breaks down very easily into paleo, which everybody knows means ancient. Ethno, that which has to do with ancient cultures, and of course botany, the study of ancient plant remains. So paleoethnobotany is simply the study of the cultural use of ancient plant remains. There are other terms with a slightly different meaning. Sometimes you'll hear people refer to archaeobotany, which of course means specifically botanical remains from archaeological context. Another one is paleobotany, which is simply means ancient plant remains, not necessarily from an archaeological context. But all of these terms are actually, in fact, very often used interchangeably. In fact, I'm sure that one of these days somebody's going to come up with a term like paleoarchaeoethnobotany, which would have a slightly different meaning, but is combined all of the different terms. Two related disciplines that we won't really be addressing, but I should just mention tonight, is palynology, which is the study of ancient, or not necessarily ancient, but usually ancient pollen and spores, and also dendrology, which is the study of trees. Of course, especially when it comes to using tree ring dating, dendrochronology, the study of ancient trees is very important. Also, you will find many universities and laboratories taking carbon charcoal samples and being able to identify the wood that was used in fires and structures of ancient buildings. But I'd like to concentrate tonight on the ancient seed remains, primarily because that's what I've worked with most and have the background in. Okay, there are four basic ways in which ancient seed material is preserved. The first one is desiccation, that is, being in a very arid environment where the seed material dries out, all of the moisture is almost literally sucked out of it. It dries up and it stays preserved. You find material like this in Egypt. We've all heard about the large pots of wheat and barley and things like that that have been found in Egyptian tombs. Now, there are some stories, too, about how you take these ancient 5,000-year-old desiccated barley grains and put a drop of water on them, and they grow. As far as I know, that's never, in fact, there have been experiments to try to do that, but it's never been successful. And I think your chances of having that be successful would be just about the same as taking a mummy, an ancient mummy, adding water to it, and see if it will spring back to life. In the process of desiccation, the cellular structure breaks down, and there's really no chance for it to be revived. Waterlogging is another way in which ancient botanical material is preserved. In fact, there are some cases in Europe where they found human beings that ended up at the bottom of a peat bog and were so perfectly preserved that they could analyze the contents of the stomach, telling what the person's last meal was. Obviously, well, maybe not so obviously, but Jordan isn't really dry enough in general to have much botanical material preserved by means of desiccation. And there's definitely not very many peat bogs around. So both desiccation and waterlogging are very infrequent ways in which botanical material is preserved here in Jordan. By far, the most common way is through carbonization, the process of carbonization. And for a plant remain to be carbonized, it has to be exposed to extreme heat, but not to direct flame. Where if you take a handful of wheat and throw it directly into the fire, it'll turn to ashes and be disintegrated. Whereas if in the process of dehusking the barley or the wheat, you're parching it or roasting it over the fire, a few grains dropped nearby the fire are far enough away that they're heated up, but not in direct contact with the fire, very often dropping into the soil and being covered slightly with the soil, then they will turn to carbon, like a charcoal briquette turns to carbon. And once that happens, that seed will be preserved for eternity, or at least thousands and thousands and thousands of years, unless a goat or a sheep or a person comes up and steps on it. They're very fragile, but they are very stable in the carbonized form. I would estimate that probably 99%, if not more, of all material, botanical material in Jordan that is preserved through the process of carbonization. One other way in which you can find ancient plant materials preserved is in pottery or mud brick impressions. They're not quite as useful as finding the carbonized material itself because, of course, it's not as easy to make a concrete identification from an impression. It's much easier with the actual seed that you get from carbonized material. In fact, sometimes you will also find the seed itself encased in a mud brick, more or less mummified. Okay, the techniques for recovery, the first one and the most obvious is a visual technique, or visual detection during excavation. And in fact, up until about 10 years ago, that was almost the only way in which any plant remains were recovered. When people were digging, they'd see a few seeds, scrape them up, put them in a bag, and usually forget about them from that point on. The problem with visual detection is that, again, you probably miss at least 99% of the botanical material if you're depending on your eyesight, because so many of the seeds are so small that you'll never be able to pick them out, especially if you're digging through an ashy layer and they blend right in with the ashy color. Another method of recovering, which is a little bit better but also has its problems, is dry sieving. That is taking the soil as you excavate and run it through a sieve. Two problems with that. First of all, most sieves have too large of holes or mesh in the screen. So that unless you have large olive pits and things like that, most of the botanical material will drop right through the screen. Of course, you can use a smaller mesh, in which case most of the dirt won't go through the screen. And even if you get just the right size of mesh so that your dirt can go through, in the process of shaking the sieve back and forth, you'll probably destroy another 50 to 75% of the botanical material, since it is going to be in a carbonized state and is very fragile. So you might end up with a lot of botanical material, but it'll probably be so broken up that you can't make any very absolute identifications. And finally, what's being used more and more is flotation. Now, there are a number of different flotation systems. One that you'll hear about quite frequently is a froth flotation system. To briefly describe that, it's a large barrel. Very often they'll have a little air compressor off to the side, which is pumping compressed air into the bottom of this barrel, which is filled with water. And with little bubbling units, it sends bubbles up through the tub. You dump a soil sample from the site in, the dirt will sink to the bottom, and the botanical material, charcoal as well as bones, snail shells, ancient insects if they're preserved, will float to the top. And you skim that off then and analyze it in the laboratory. Some people will insist that the froth flotation system is the only way to go. It's certainly true that you can process massive amounts of soil through a froth flotation system, and you do get a high degree of recovery. What you don't often hear people talk about is the fact that in a froth flotation system, very often they'll use the same water in this tank until it finally gets so full of dirt that you have to flush the system out and then you start all over again. A problem with that, if you think about it, if you're digging stratigraphically and you put one sample in from a Neolithic layer and an hour later you're in a Bronze Age level and you dump a soil sample into the flotation system, some of the smaller seeds will stay suspended below the surface. And so you'll get cross-contamination between different loci or different soil layers. Another problem with the idea of floating all of the soil on the site in order to get a large sample is that the laboratory analysis of a flotation sample takes so long that if you do float all the soil on the site, it's virtually impossible for anybody to ever analyze all the material that you recover. So usually with these large flotation systems, you'll end up in the laboratory taking a sample of the samples that you got from the field. And finally, one of the problems with big systems like this is that they're fairly expensive to buy or to build. And expense is a very major factor in most archaeological projects. And so a lot of projects just can't afford it, or at least don't want to make that kind of a financial outlay for a froth flotation system. The flotation system that we've used at Baba Drawn, which is more common here, is a very simple tub flotation system. And it simply involves, we'll see a picture in a minute, either a barrel or a large cooking type pot, which you fill half full with water and insert a screen bottom bucket. Then you dump the soil sample into the screen bottom bucket while somebody turns it or churns it, which agitates the water. Again, your soil will float to the bottom or sink to the bottom. The botanical material floats to the top. You skim it off and then let it dry. The reason for having the screen on the bottom of the one bucket is that there are certain large seeded plants like olive and very often wheat and barley, which won't float to the top. So the screen on the bottom allows the dirt to go through the screen while it catches any of the larger seeds. Before we actually look at a slide of the system, should back up and say something about the actual recovery of the material in the field. One of the problems that you'll find on most archaeological excavations is that even if they have somebody doing flotation, the people who are actually digging the squares have so many things on their mind, bagging up pottery, bagging up flint, bagging up bones, that they'll very often forget to take soil samples for flotation. And it is very important that you take soil samples on a regular basis so that you have an idea as to what botanical materials are contained in the different layers as you excavate them. Even if you don't suspect any botanical material in the layer you're working in, you ought to take periodic samples just to make sure that the soil is as sterile as you think. Definitely, if you come across an ashy layer while you're excavating, especially if it's an ashy layer on a floor or near a hearth, that is the best place to take a soil sample because it was very likely had something to do with an area where rubbish was being burned or food was being processed, and that's where you get most of your botanical material. So very, very seldom, if you find an ashy lens in a site, will it be sterile of botanical remains, unless it was such a hot fire that everything was consumed. But if there's any charcoal visible at all, you're almost sure to find botanical remains in ashy layers. Okay, I think we'll go at this point. We've got just a few slides to look at. And we'll see, I'm not sure if we'll even need to turn the lights on. Okay, can everybody see that with the lights on? Maybe. Somebody could just hit those four switches by the cabinet. Okay, as I mentioned, sometimes you can find botanical remains through simple visual detection. It doesn't show up too clearly here. This is taken at the site of Babbitt at Numera, which is an early bronze III site. Here you can see, in fact, a very rare find, a flint sickle blade and part of the wooden hafting, which of course is in pretty bad shape at this point. Over here is a lot of barley. Actually, there were about 7,000 or 8,000 grains of barley, and this is, in fact, not very clear, but a head of barley that was found on the floor. This is another example of botanical remains that were spotted visually on the site. When Numera was destroyed, evidently during the last destruction, there were a lot of grapes, whole grapes that were fresh, that had just been picked. And during the destruction of the village, these grapes were burned or carbonized in place. It's actually rather an interesting find. There are about 1,000 grapes in this one particular area. We don't have any idea, of course, the exact year that Numera was destroyed, but we do know the time of the year. It would have had to have been in the summertime when grapes were in season, since grape is not the type of plant that you can pick and keep for 5 or 6 months and they'll stay in a fresh condition. So it was probably in June or July when the site of Numera was destroyed. Okay, this is the equipment that I was just referring to, a flotation tank, which is filled about half full of water, the screen bottom bucket, And then this is a regular kitchen strainer, which you use to scrape off the float or the light fraction, which comes up to the top containing the botanical remains. And then we usually use a very fine brass wire gauze screen or carburetor screen. Sometimes people use pantyhose or nylon, which is very fine. It'll pick up the very tiny, especially wild seeds. This was a system we had used the previous year, just an old oil drum. The reason we opted for the smaller pot was just to save water. In fact, one of the things we've done, and it is water consuming, but I think it's the only safe way to keep your different botanical remains separate, is every time you run a sample, at the end of it, completely clean the entire system, not only the flotation tank, but all the screens, so that it's a brand new clean system when you introduce the next soil sample. If you're running five or six samples from the same locus, then it's not a problem. You can keep using the same water. But if you ever change locus, you ought to change the water. Along with running the samples, which take usually from 15 minutes to a half hour to run one sample, you'll almost always keep a flotation notebook in which you mark down the initial finds, whether there's a lot of botanical material in this particular soil sample or whether it's sterile. During the course of the excavation, then the individual square supervisors will come to the flotation supervisor and say, what was in my sample that I submitted 3 days ago? You might not be able to give a full report of all the genus and species and so forth, but you can say at least that, yes, you are producing a lot of botanical material, you ought to take more samples, or, you know, last 25 samples you submitted are all sterile, don't take so many. That's a problem, in fact, that you do often run into. It always seems that the most conscientious people, the ones who are taking most of the samples, are working in squares that are totally devoid of botanical materials. And all the people with the nice ash layers fail to collect the samples. This gives you an idea of what a sample looks like after it's floated. Before I deal with this, I should mention that after you skim off the heavy or the light fraction of the float, you have to be very careful about drying it out. Now, some people have a tendency to put it on newspaper or very absorbent paper so it'll dry quickly. One of the problems is that botanical carbonized material is very delicate, and if it dries too quickly, it'll explode. So you want it to dry very slowly, usually over a period of 2 or 3 days. And the best way to do that is just to lay the wet float out on a plastic bag, put it in a room where you don't have to worry about airborne contamination, let it dry for 3 or 4 days, then package it up, and then the packages are taken off to the laboratory for analysis. Okay, a lot of what you get are little fragments of charcoal, which really aren't that useful. Sometimes they can be used for wood identification, but generally they're so small that you can't use them for that purpose. So, say if you take about a half an hour to float a sample, you'll probably spend anywhere from 4 to 60 hours in the laboratory just sorting out, throwing away the garbage that you're not interested in, and picking out seeds before you go to the next step of actually identifying the seeds. You might be able to pick out some things. Right here is a barley grain. This is a wild plant. Actually, this is cabezi, which is often used today. Rame Khoury knows a lot about cabezi and wrote an article last year about its wonderful health and life-prolonging aspects. Some of the seeds are very small, like this one is a fig pit, which is a little less than a millimeter in diameter. It might look very confusing when you initially look at something like this, but if you just keep in mind as you're sorting through that you're looking for geometric forms. Almost all seeds are either round, spherical, oblong, flattish, but they will be symmetrical in some way, even though the shape can be all different kinds of shapes. And after a while, you get so you can sort through something like this very quickly. After you separate out the garbage from the good seeds, are usually mounted in something like this. I usually use coin holders, which coin collectors use, or you can use glass vials very often. You have to have the actual sample to make positive identifications, but here you can see a couple barley grains, wheat grain. These are chenopods, a couple of fig pips. These I'm not sure about. Here's a grape seed or pip, a piece of an olive seed and so forth. Another shot of grape pips. They are really the easiest thing to identify, and I've set out a flotation sample up here very much like this, and it does have quite a bit of grape if you want to look through the magnifier to see it. And then these are flax. Flax is usually fairly easy to identify too. It's a very long, oblong seed with a little beak on the top. Okay, that's all the slides. You can have the lights again. Boy, I'm really going to have to race at this point. One thing is kind of a pet peeve of mine. People very often in the field will not spend the time they need in handling the material properly. And in order to save time, rather than bringing this light fraction or float back to the laboratory to sort through, they'll have locals sort through the material right in the field. The problem with that is that many of the seeds are so small you can't see them without some kind of a magnifier like this, or at least a handheld magnifier. And so if you do sort in the field, generally you'll, especially if you're using locals, you'll skew your sample in favor of larger seeds. And in fact, very few fig seeds are found in excavations, whereas at Baba Yaw, they're one of the most common plants found. And I'm sure that the reason for that is that the fig seeds are so tiny that they're generally just right. But there are problems with both. And some of the problems are that seeds are very often damaged, either in antiquity or during the flotation process. A lot of your material is destroyed while you're putting it through this rather traumatic system, dumping it in water and then taking it out and drying it out and so forth. And because of that damage, it's very often impossible to measure the seeds or to be able to tell exactly what the original measurements are. Also, in the process of carbonization itself, the shape and size of the seed usually changes. And it doesn't change consistently, depending on the amount of moisture that was in the seed when it was carbonized. And of course, there's no way for you to ever determine how moist it was. The seed might either expand or contract or melt and become very difficult to identify. Also, many species are almost exactly the same shape and size, so you might be able to make a genus identification, but if you ever read a report, a paleobotanist report in which he's giving the genus and species of every single plant remain that he's recovering, you can be pretty certain that that person's going out on a limb, because generally you can't be that specific with the material you're recovering. Also, there's quite a bit of overlapping. If you take, for instance, wheat, two early varieties of wheat, Einkorn and Emmer, there's quite a bit of overlapping in the size of Einkorn and Emmer. So if you have one or two grains, it can be very difficult sometimes to tell whether it's Einkorn or Emmer, whereas if you have a larger sample, then you have a much better chance of being correct in your identification. Also, when you're thinking about the size and shape of the plants, you have to realize that that's also dependent upon how healthy the plant was when it was
involved in its growing cycle, and how much water it was getting. In general, domesticated plants will be larger than wild plants, simply because people have a tendency to select for large, plump grains of barley rather than the small, thin ones. On the other hand, you might have a farmer that's working in a very arid area. He has unhealthy barley, so the seeds that are being produced are very small, whereas you might have a wild barley stand that's very healthy and virile, getting a lot of water, and that wild barley might be producing grains that are twice as large as your domesticated barley. So there are problems like that to contend with. Just a few examples, and these will be the easiest examples. If you're trying to make a basic identification as to whether a plant or a seed is wild or domesticated, grapes are maybe the easiest of all. If I can draw a circle. In general, and it's always statistical, in general, a wild grape will be very spherical and will have what's called the dorsal shield, but a very indistinct dorsal shield and a very small stalk. Whereas a domesticated grape, and the one that most of us are familiar with as you eat a grape and you look at the next grape you eat, you'll notice that it's almost a heart shape or a pear shape, has a very distinct dorsal shield and generally a very long stalk. Now again, you can get into problems because not all grape seeds look like that. It might just come around a little bit more. This stalk may be broken off and look something like that, so it's a little harder to distinguish. But in general, that's the way you distinguish between wild and domesticated grape. When it comes to the cereals, I'm a terrible artist, but I hope this will at least give you some idea. Okay, with cereals, you have a stalk, which turns out to be straw after it's harvested. And then on the actual grain or spike where you get the grains growing, if you tear, and we've got an example here of some two-row barley, if you want to come up afterwards and tear the grains off, you'll find that you have these little things that are called rachis internodes. So the rachis is a part of the stem where the spike or the grains are. Now in wild wheat and barley, what happens once the plant becomes ripe is that these internodes are very brittle and they'll break. So that when the wind comes along, the rachis internodes break apart, and of course it's the seed dispersal mechanism of the plant for propagation. Whereas when people started to harvest wheat or barley, you can imagine if you come along and cut this with a sickle, that in most cases, a lot of your wild grains are going to fall off immediately and you won't catch them. You're going to have a tendency to collect those grains which are growing on plants which have a tough rachis or rachis, which means, in other words, that these things are holding on. So, I've got an example. Actually, we'll see how tough this is by passing it around. This is actually modern wheat, and it's obviously domesticated wheat because it's got tough rachis, these little internodes, still after the flotation process are still clinging together. If that was wild, you'd have those little internodes all broken apart. And in fact, we do have some wild barley here that you can see that happening to. Boy, I'm very dull. out when we're going to get through this. Okay. One other example is the distinction between two-row barley and six-row barley. We have an example here of two-row barley, and in two-row barley, on every one of those little raucous internodes, you'll find one grain growing, with this little furrow, and then two little sterile florets on the side. So you'll have one of those seeds over here, and then one on the other side, and so forth. So when you talk about two row, it just means on these two rows, there's two grades. Whereas with six row barley, you find the same basic structure with the central grain, and these sterile florets are suddenly regular grains of barley as well. And what happens then, because it's very crowded on the one spike, you'll find this ventral furrow is twisted to a certain extent. So if you're looking through a sample of barley and you want to know whether it's two-row barley or six-row barley, if it's six-row barley, theoretically, two-thirds of the grains ought to have a twisted ventral furrow, and one-third ought to be very symmetrical because they are that central grain. What's interesting, though, then when you get to the carbonization process, is that very often in the carbonization process, all the grains are twisted, so it can become very difficult to determine whether or not the twisting is, in fact, due to the fact that it is six-row barley, or if it's due to the fact that it's a carbonized sample. And in fact, I won't use any names, but probably two of the most well-known paleobotanical experts in the world. I had some of the samples from Babadraw, and I took them to one fellow and asked, how would you identify this particular grain? He looked at it, it had a twisted furrow, and he said, it's absolutely six-row barley. There's no question, the lateral grain. Took it to the other fellow, and he was certain that it was emmer, which is a type of wheat. So they didn't even agree on whether it was wheat or barley. And he explained this twisting as being due to the carbonization process, and he said it looks like an immature grain, probably a diseased grain. So those are the kind of debates that you can get into, not only what species is it, or subspecies, but what family it belongs to. I'm just not going to get into the reconstruction of the agricultural systems, I'm afraid. I would like to close by talking about some of the problems involved in the interpretation of botanical material. Next time we will talk about the many good things that you can find from botanical material and how detailed you can get in the reconstruction of the agricultural system. But I'd like to warn you, because I'll probably be going overboard coming up with these wonderful theories at that time. In fact, you've got to be very careful about trying to get a representative sample. And articles are being written all the time about this flotation machine gets a much more representative sample than this other type of process. When you think about it, you prejudice your sample from the very beginning as soon as you determine where you're going to dig. Nobody can dig an entire site. You generally pick out an area that is, and choose to excavate an area that is no more than 5% of the site, and usually much less than that. And of course, the botanical material that you do find and that you don't find is going to be determined upon where you dig. Obviously, if you are working at a Roman site and you choose to dig in the theater, it's very unlikely that you're going to get very much botanical material. And of course, if that's what you're interested in, you should be digging in the theater. Another problem with getting a a representative sample is, as I've mentioned before, the fact that most archaeologists just aren't that careful about collecting the botanical samples on a frequent basis. In fact, there was an example of a project last year that they were doing flotation on. I've read their final report, and they conclude almost nothing about the ancient agricultural system, because the best squares where most of the charcoal was, no samples were taken. And the other samples were taken so erratically and sloppily, mixing different layers together, that it's very difficult to determine the exact date of the botanical material that you do have. Another problem is, of course, that material is damaged by the flotation process itself. I would estimate at least 20% of the carbonized material that goes into the flotation system never comes out. It just dissolves or explodes as soon as it hits the water. Another problem that you have is that not all botanical material has an equal chance of being exposed to the conditions necessary for carbonization. What I mean by that is that wheat and barley very often were parched over a fire as a part of the food processing system, as kind of after it was threshed and before it was ground, it was parched. Very seldom do you fry peas or chickpeas or other vegetables, hummus. Generally, the legumes are eaten raw or perhaps boiled in water, but very seldom are they around an open fire. Also, not only are they not around an open fire as often as wheat and barley grains are, but if a pea or, in fact, a grape gets close to fire, its chances of being carbonized and surviving that carbonization process are not as strong as it is for a barley grain and wheat grain. So again, that leads into another thing, and that is when you're trying to determine which were the most important crops, which foods were being consumed to the greatest extent, again, you've got to be careful with the numbers game. Chances are you're going to find more wheat and more barley than anything else because they were usually exposed to fire. That doesn't necessarily mean that people were growing more wheat and more barley than anything else. Okay, and finally, just to mention that perhaps the greatest problem is that paleobotanical studies are still pretty much in their youth, so much so that very little has been done in terms of refining the techniques of identification so that you do find the leading experts with a wide variety of ideas as to how things should be identified. And until we make more progress in being sure that we can identify things correctly, we're going to define still, I think, a great deal of debate. In closing, I'd like to just point out a little bit of the literature that is available. There are a number of books here in my study and in the library dealing with the origins of archaeology. This is a collection of papers. The editor is Charles Reed. This is perhaps one of the most comprehensive collections of essays and bibliography, if you're interested. Also, this book on the domestication and exploitation of plants and animals and prehistoric agriculture are more or less standard works very often used as textbooks in universities. This little book, Crops of Man, is very simply written, very easy to read by a fellow by the name of Jack Harlan, who's at the conference and will be presenting a paper, also quite interesting. For actual seed identification, a book by Jane Renfrew on paleoethnobotany is, again, more or less a standard work, although there are a number of rather weak areas in the book. And also this little book on seed identification is very, very useful. It actually has photographs of seeds, in large photographs, and then in the corner, actual seed sizes. I'd also say that you'll find, in trying to identify ancient plants, I thought when I first became involved in this, well, I'll go to the University of Jordan and back in Pittsburgh to the Hunt Botanical Library and so forth, where you have botanists, taxonomists working on identification of plant species night and day for 20, 30 years. And I found very often as you bring carbonized seeds into a highly trained, highly experienced plant taxonomist, that they'll just laugh at you and say, well, we really can't make an identification based just on the seed. If you'll bring me the stem and the roots and the flowers, then I might be able to tell you something. And so it is amazing that very few botanists themselves have done much work with ancient botanical material and especially ancient carbonized material. One other thing that is very helpful, especially if you're interested in wild flora, are the volumes by Zahari called Flora Palestina. These are the first two volumes, a volume of texts and then a volume of plates. Those can be very important for identifying the wild plant remains. He doesn't really deal with pultigens. And one thing that I failed to mention is that not only when you're recovering the ancient botanical remains are you interested in the pultigens, but the wild plants are very important because they can very often indicate changes in climate. We know that agricultural systems change. Today they're growing tomatoes and eggplants in the Jordan Valley, and of course they weren't 50 years ago and they weren't 8,000 years ago. Those are recently introduced pultigens. On the other hand, the wild flora, if you find in your ancient assemblage certain wild species, and then you go out and make a modern collection around the site and find almost identical species growing today, that's a fairly good indication that the climatic conditions haven't changed dramatically, at least not dramatically enough to alter the wild vegetation. Whereas if you do get dramatic changes between your ancient assemblage of wild plants and the modern wild plant cover, you can again be assured of fairly extensive changes in the environment, natural environment. This is another book by Zahari, The Plant Life of Palestine, which also, if you're interested in plant groupings, different plant communities and where they grow, where they're indigenous, that's very helpful. And finally, if you're interested in the archaeological material, both journals and a few site reports can be very helpful. This volume has one of the best extensive articles on paleobotany written by a fellow by the name of Hans Halbeck, who is recently deceased. Halbeck, a woman by the name of Maria Holt, who's in Mainz, also Wilhelm van Seist from Groningen, Holland, who's here again at the conference, and Jack Harlan, I would say, are probably the leading names in the fields of paleoethnobotany. So anything that you pick up that's written by those people, you can be assured that they're pretty dependable information. Okay, I'm not sure when we'll do this again. We won't have class on Wednesday, but I will pick up and some way talk a little bit about the ancient agricultural system of Bob the Draw. Yeah, Gary.
When did man first eat bread?
When did first eat bread? That's a good question. No? Okay. I'd say probably around 50,000 years ago.
Thank you. Do you have time for a question or
not? Yeah, I do have to run pretty quickly, but yeah, if you have a question.
What's the difference between cultivated and domesticated plant? You seem to use domesticated plant.
Right, a domesticated plant is one which is artificially planted and harvested. And in fact, if you take the example of the barley again, okay, that's your rackets, which is going to hold the grains, right? Remember I mentioned with wild plants, this is a brittle rackets, so it flies apart when the wind comes. With domesticated wheat or barley, it becomes tough, so that once you cut it with a sickle blade, it all falls into your basket.
So I thought cultivated meant, you know, man cultivated.
Right. But so after a long time of cultivation, the grain has to develop a tough rachis, because all of the brittle rachis plants are lost. They're blown away, and you collect the tough rachis plants, you replant them, so you're selecting for that particular thing. Now, it turns out that, say, if you have this tough rachis and people stop cultivating it, it would very quickly die off, because when the wind comes up, it's tough rachis, the seeds aren't dispersed, therefore they don't grow anymore. And the wild varieties, those few plants that have brittle rachises, would make a comeback.
So those two words are more or less synonymous, cultivated and domesticated.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, now you... Yeah, I should make a little bit of a qualification there. Certainly we know at Baba Dra and at a number of ancient sites, there are plants such as one that's called Ziziphus spinachristi, or dome is the Arabic word for it. It grows in the valley, and it has an edible seed. It grows wild. Nobody really goes out and plants the tree, but they do harvest it. Not really cultivating it, but they harvest it. And the same you could say with Khabezi. I imagine that some people actually do plant little plots of Khabezi, but generally it grows wild. People go out, pick it. Especially a year ago, they almost picked all the Khabezi out in the country. But it is a wild plant that is utilized as part of the human diet, but it's not really a domesticated plant.
Thank you.
Okay. The antiquities department. It's near Third Circle. No, that's a different place. This goes to Russell Pine. Did you just pick that up yourself, or did any other get it?